Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of the War Stories Podcast. I am Tom, and I am joined for, as we're taking it into the home stretch, by Jacob for the Marines in Afghanistan series. We have, I think, this one and one more. Is that about right, Jacob? This is, today will be the push into Sangin with your brothers from Lima Company.
Yep. Yeah. We're going to do, this episode with, the push with the Lima Company guys. And then we're going to go into, with, the India Company guys, once they pushed in, because they were supporting us on the far side of the river during our push. And then they ended up getting pulled out eventually and, doing their own push into Sangin there. So we're going to be covering all of Lima Company guys today and going from there.
And to that end, we have Birch, Mike, and Rob here with us. I'm going to start with Birch. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. And we've got Mike and Rob. Let's start with Birch. What was your role with Lima, and how did you end up as the Devil Dog?
Well, in Lima Company, I was second squad leader. First platoon, and I mean, just running and gunning, being a squad leader.
Yeah, did you sign up? Like, had you been in a while, or how did you end up in the Marine Corps in the first place?
I think, let's see, this 2009, I'd been in a little over 6 years. I joined in 2003, and like most early 2000 teenagers, 9/11 really is what made me want to join the Marine Corps. So made that choice and lived 12 beautiful years in it.
And you ended up after 12 years not wanting to be a lifer, I take it.
Family, man. Family. It was a flip of a coin.
Sometimes it really does come down to that. It's like, should I stay in? Nah.
it really does. And my kids were, dad was gone too much on deployments, and my kids were only seeing their dad very so often. So it was time to hang the guns up.
And with you, we have Mike. And Mike was also in Lima Company. Tell us what you did in Lima Company and how you ended up in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, bro. I was a squad leader in, I was 2-1. So I was in second platoon, Birch and Rob's sister platoon here. And, yeah, man, enlisted in, September 11th, 2005. So these two probably
right on the anniversary.
Yeah, man. Right on the anniversary. I'm pretty junior to these knuckleheads, but yeah, so enlisted, probably pretty obvious as to why. I was kind of going nowhere fast, as a 19-year-old punk ass kid. So, had my priorities pretty messed up and obviously, the events of that day, kind of weighed heavy on our generation. So enlisted in the Marine Corps, man, did fake ass SEAL team for a little bit, missed out on Ramadi in 3-7, because of that, but it was all good. I got orders from there to 3-7, and, that's all I needed to know, right? It was like, hey man, these guys are coming back from Iraq and, you're going to Jason Dunham's battalion, right? So that's kind of how it was illustrated to the young corporal. And so, I knew, hey man, like you got to show up and perform. And literally I'm in the company office for 5 minutes, and Gunny Hatch was the company gunny for Lima Company at the time. And he looks at me and he goes, second platoon, third squad for that back go around. And he's like, so don't F it up, right? So it's like, all right, cool, man. Here we go.
No pressure, you know. So,
yeah, exactly. Yep.
Going to the 3-7 to begin with is a reputation to live up to or down to, depending on which direction you're looking. And then have a gunny say, here's a squad, don't fuck it up, is a big responsibility, I'm sure, especially for a 19-year-old.
Yeah, bro. Yeah. I was, 22 at the time, but yeah, still just young, impressionable, and only having a couple of years going to the war hardened battalion of the cutting edge. So you knew what you had to live up to for sure.
And then last but certainly not least, Rob, how are you, sir?
Good. How you doing?
Oh, just, glad to be, surviving. As Jacob knows, we battled the Rona in this house pretty hard for the last 2 weeks. Oh. So it's Team War Stories 6, Rona 0 is our score currently. Rob, what did you do in Lima Company, and then how did you end up in the Marine Corps?
So, I was the first squad leader for first platoon. So same platoon as Birch. I actually was the most senior out of all three of us, time in service wise. I came in the Marine Corps June of 2002. My senior year was 9/11. I'd always wanted to be a Marine, came up, was from a Marine Corps family. My dad did 28 years, but I want to go to college, but I was also making dumb knuckleheaded decisions. So, on 9/11, I decided, screw it, I'm going to go do my part. And instead of failing out of college, I got to be a Marine Corps grunt. Coming to 3-7, I'd already done 3 deployments to Iraq with 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. So this was my 4th combat deployment at that time.
That makes you pretty salty to the other guys, and they kind of look up to you at that point going, holy shit, this guy's seen some shit. And,
They're boot to me, but honestly, they're the best group of Marines I'd ever served with. Like, the sergeants in that battalion at that time were just, all of them were amazing. So
I have other nicknames for him, but I love him.
I'm sure, I'll bet. Oh yeah, before we even started recording, just as your face has popped up and you got, I might as well not even have been here, the camaraderie was flying with insults and giving people shit. So I guess we're gonna talk about your guys' push into Sangin, and we're gonna start with a little bit of background leading up to our starting point, which would be, I guess you said April 13th, 2010, is that right?
August 13th, 2010.
Well, that's a big, I mean, if you're going to pick a day to go into, you know, some shit, that's a Friday the 13th. Why does it not as well, right?
Yeah. It was literally Friday the 13th, so why not give it hell?
Yeah.
Baptism by fire. Here we go.
Yeah. Make your own luck.
Figure it out.
So who's going to give us the background? Rob, is that something you want to tackle? Or
yeah. He's the senior, lead off, buddy.
All right.
He's the oldest, so is his memory okay?
I don't know. I'm getting old. And I've been hitting the head a lot. So a
couple times.
We'd already been, by the time we got to Sangin, we'd been in country about 5 months, 6 months at that point. Yep. We had started, like the rest of the battalion, a little bit farther out west. The battalion gradually worked its way east through like different operations. But Lima Company got detached from 3-7 and sent down to Marja to assist 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines down there. We spent about 2 months or so on, they called it Sistani Peninsula. It's just off of Marja, like the only green area surrounded by a bunch of desert. We were down there for 2 or 3 months. Got told that we were going back to 3-7 to go clear through Sangin. And getting up there was an experience. It took us 3 days driving through the desert, each platoon.
Oh, no. I hitched a ride in a helo.
The rest of us.
Yeah, 67.
He's lucky. He got a ride in a helo, too, but it was in the opposite direction.
Oh, whoa, we're not there yet. Come on. I know.
Those, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
The first time, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, hit a couple
of feet.
Got there. And, I mean, by now it's my fourth deployment. Everywhere you go, you hear, oh, this place is so bad. This place is so bad. When you get there, it's not that bad. Sangin is the first and only time when I got there, it was worse. Our day there, they almost shot down a CH-53 heavy lift helicopter. I had to make an emergency landing in the green zone.
You and I, Rob, you and I watched that damn, we were watching that bird take off and the damn RPG comes flying over the top of the ESCO and it's like, oh shit.
Yeah, it's been there. Good. They've been there less than 24 hours, and they're already telling me I'm going to have to get back in my vehicle. It's going to go do a trap mission to rescue the crew, potentially. And we spent a day or two.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, that's when Colonel Tipton's on the roof at Nole with the British Royal Commando Battalion Commander. Like, as this is going down, it's like, get off the roof, please.
You guys are silhouetting yourself really badly right now. That's like when we first reached the river on our end, and him and Black decided to walk out there, and they're like, oh, you see, this isn't that bad. We're just going to stand in the river. And then next thing you know, it's just hellfire. And we're like, thanks, guys. Yeah, great. Cool.
But yeah, the Helms got shot down, spent like a day or two at Fob Jackson, and then pushed over to Patrol Base Falad, and that's where... On the 12th, and then the next morning is when we pushed out.
So now, what was the objective that you were given, or was it just, hey, go in there and destroy anything that tries to kill you, or did you actually have an objective that you had to accomplish? Because I know Jacob has told us some of his previous orders were basically walk that way and kill anything that moves until we tell you to stop.
Yeah.
It was a clearing zone.
It was definitely a clearing zone, man. I think
you were saying a clearing zone using tree lines as phase lines, but in all actuality, what it turned into was go out there, keep moving, and keep killing bad guys until they're done.
So right. From the same conversation from the rooftop from battalion commander to battalion commander was, and so just, I guess, to preface my comments, I just spent the last 3.5 years working with Colonel Tipton at EOTG on the West Coast. And so we've actually had a lot of amazing conversations about that deployment, which kind of shed a lot of light on a lot of gaps I had just due to a couple of medevacs and just being blown up like 9 times over 2 deployments. But anyway, so don't stand too close to me in a lightning storm. But yeah.
You're telling me God has it out for you?
I think so. I know if I got 9 lives, I've used all of them, bro. Like, for sure.
I'm right there with
he
you,
told
man.
Me from that. Oh, I know, Birch. Yeah, you make my stuff look like child's play, bro. He told me from that conversation that the battalion commander from the 40th commando is like pointing to the tree line to the west of the 611. I mean, you're talking, what, Rob, 200 meters? No more?
If that.
Mm-hmm. If that. And he's like, hey, you guys are going to cross that highway, cross that linear danger area, go through that tree line, and you're done. And of course, Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel's like, okay, cool, bet, right? Like, literally the tactical task was like, go west and clear, right? Like, and from what I know, that kind of kicked off the one platoon that's missing is our third platoon, but them being supporting effort too on that operation, like, they LD'd, man. And, Joel Riley was their, he wasn't their platoon sergeant, but he was our company, like, JTAC, and he was with them on that initial push, and the Brits weren't bullshit. And you go through that tree line, it was like U-shape ambush type stuff. It was awesome. We obviously did some good things on that initial, that push through there to gain some kind of ground and some kind of terrain, but they weren't sugarcoating anything. Like Rob said, this place was living up to it, and then some, pretty quickly. So
I remember on the night of the 12th, one of the Royal Marine Commandos asked me how long we were going to be in the Northern Green Zone, and I told him we were planning on 2 weeks, and his exact words were, I don't like being out there for 2 hours. I doubt you make 2 days. And we were out there for 32 days straight.
Yeah.
What I've heard, when you guys showed up, the Royal Marines had quite a bit to say about that area. And
well, I mean, it was to the point where, like, on the other side of the 611, how they brought it up, even all the way, the 611 went all the way down to our AO with Kilo Company, and they had white flags. Yeah, down at Inkerman from Nolay to Jackson, and they had white flags hanging in the trees going all the way down as a purity zone that, like, basically under the, whatever you want to call it, jihad, that infidels weren't allowed into that zone. So, you know, some of us were smart asses and stole the white flags, but I forget who it was. I forget who ended up getting hit when they stole one. I don't know if that was Lima or India Company, but somebody ended up getting hit.
That was our EOD guys. Yeah.
Yeah. But we were collecting them as I'm like a giant fuck you. Like, yeah, okay, we're going to go where we want to go. And we basically did kind of emphasize what they were saying is that, like, they estimated 3-7, just the three and a half months the total of the battalion was down there. They estimated we ended up eliminating over 900 hostiles. Just through those 3 months that we were going out there picking fights and killing bad guys.
Yeah. On the
flag- it was the battalion's motto, man. It was, again, just knowing Colonel Tipton a little more nowadays than I did back then, obviously. It, the 40th, man, those guys are savages. Those guys are awesome and did a lot of great things, and they're obviously our number one ally, but they look like Greek gods, right? Like walking around the FOB, like working out 17 times a day. And like, just, you picture this warfighter with an awesome accent, right? You're like, dude, I want to go on patrol with you, man. And then as soon as there's contact, bro, like they are like laying down some fire, dropping some air and beating feet. And so they just weren't gaining the ground that obviously Colonel Tipton was going to accept, right? So like it was not just gain contact with the enemy, but maintain contact with the enemy. And that was, that obviously showed itself over the next 90 days for sure.
Yeah. Going to the flag thing. I don't know. Definitely when you cross those white flags, you were in Taliban land, you know, Kablamistan. But, yeah, one time we picked up a like radio counter. They were trying to find where our platoon was. So not only did we start like singing like Journey and Queen songs, but we grabbed one corpsman and four Marines, so we had the same amount as the flag raising on Iwo Jima. We took one of their white flags, tied it to a stick, reenacted the flag raising, and then lit it on fire. They didn't like that much because they started shooting at us a few minutes later, well, but it didn't work out well for them anyway. So
that's unfortunate that they don't like it, but, you know, that's fucking bad.
They also don't like it when you pull your britches around your ankles and stick your ass over the top.
Yeah, they don't like that either.
Okay, yeah, that was me.
They didn't like that either.
That was the first one.
They didn't like that.
I told them I was going to show them a white flag. And
I think they threw grenades at you guys because of that.
A lot.
It's how very Scottish of you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. At least me and Hood, we just get a flag and we just flick it off and put it on Facebook. You know, that's what we did.
I think my cover photo on Facebook. It was for the longest time.
Yeah, yeah, same.
So for the sure. Morning of Friday the 13th, what do you guys, how do you start? How does it start and what's your next move, you know?
Well, I'm at Bastion. So Rob, can you take it from there? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Mike was on vacation. Cause he's
whoa. Boom. Wow.
Hey, it wasn't your fault.
Shots fired.
It's like union mandated break, right?
Yeah, right.
August 13th, my squad was actually the lead squad for the platoon, mm-hmm. Or for the company, I'm sorry. And we push out a PB for Lodge across the 611.
I was in trace with you.
Yep. Across the 611 and down a route called Route Triumph. And plan was to go up about two tree lines. And first platoon would break to the west, and third platoon following behind us would break to the east, and we'd just literally clear on line going north. We started taking ineffective fire, some pop shots before I even reached the bottom of the hill coming out of the PB. Our platoon, we still had like a third of my platoon was still inside the patrol base, and we're already getting shot at. And we pushed up.
Rob, on that one, when we hit Route Triumph, we had that one single shot, and that was when that damn sniper popped that Brit through like a three and a half inch gap.
Yeah, as we're when we got to Route Triumph, Birch is talking about, there was a sniper out there. Royal Marine was on post at the LOD and turned his head. Didn't really realize, but there's a like 3 or 4 inch gap between two pieces of bulletproof glass. And when he turned his head, he exposed his head to that gap. And this sniper hit him from about 500 meters out in that gap. So, yeah.
And so these are no shit fucking trained fighters. If they can thread a needle like that to smack this Brit with a headshot from 500 meters in a 3 inch gap.
If it's like a competitive Syrian sniper, wasn't it, Rob, or something like that? I don't remember.
It was a teenager. A 3-5 guy. Teenage. The same one that got, oh my God, the 50 one. He's got the tattoo. Five clicks to the right and try again.
Oh, yeah, Haney. Yeah, when he got shot down there with us, we had that teenage chick because she got, ended up shooting Haney, and then she shot Renshaw, and then, but she was off on her, deal at first when she was targeting us, where she was like five clicks off. So it was like they got tattoos on their arm where they both got shot the same, where it's like five clicks left, better luck next time. And because then we also had the
hit him in the same spot, but it was, you know, like you said, five clicks over.
Yeah. And then she ended up adjusting.
That's right.
Yeah. The Chestian guys, that was a the Chessin fuckheads that showed up when I was killing my own people, because they were all redhead fuckers that, you know, there can only be one Highlander, so I was winning. Because when they were first over there, that's like something that popped up for us weeks later, that they were maneuvering on us as fast as we were maneuvering on them, and they were very effective, and we didn't know what the hell was going on, and then we ended up killing like a handful of them. And we get up there and we were doing dead checks and intel checks, just searching the bodies and taking weapons and ammo and everything. And we noticed these guys weren't exactly from around there, because they were all white and red bearded and, you know, red haired and everything else. And so we called it up over the radio, and our intel guy comes over and he's just like, oh, yeah, no, I got intel like a week or two back that there might be some Chessin mercenaries out there. Didn't really think anything of it. I'm like, why are you even here? Thanks for the heads up. That would have been great to fucking know.
Information that could have been useful yesterday. Now, wait, I have a technical question. Maybe you guys could answer this, because I don't know if Jacob will give me a real answer, but maybe if you guys know, when one redhead kills other redheads, does that redhead absorb all the other souls that those redheads he has killed has
absolutely absorbed? It's like vampires, bro.
Soul is ginger
zero and get anything but zero, so redheads will never have a soul even if they steal them or kill them.
Exactly. We don't actually, at least we don't actually suck up the souls of the other redheaded souls that this person killed.
Well, it's just the freckles. That's how we keep count. You don't actually have a soul still. It's just the freckles.
Jake,
you're doing pretty good then, bro. Yeah, you're crushing it, dude.
Nailed it.
Leprechauns, you decimate it.
All right, well, we're going to go out to have a grand old time here.
Stay out of the Jameson.
I haven't even started that
more
yet.
Game over for Jake. Oh, God. Here we go.
This is going to quickly devolve into other things, but...
debauchery.
Yeah.
Yeah, but right. Yeah, so they had that situation, and then, yeah, I'll let them continue from there.
We pushed in, Rob, and, like, when we hit Route Triumph, that we had that sniper take that pop shot. You know, of course, when we exited Flood, we went in pretty much squad platoon order. And, well, I don't remember, Mike. They were third, weren't they, in the line?
Yeah, I wasn't. So August 9th, bro, I was medevaced on August 9th and was gone for 2 weeks. So I didn't come back till like the 17th. Or no, I don't do math in public. That's terrible. Like the 27th.
You're also a product of Alabama education system. So
that Alabama education, bro. Yeah. I was gone for the initial push. Yep.
You know, second on the downed vehicles in the desert from when Mike got hit. They came up like a day or two later. They got up with us.
Yep. Check. Copy.
Yeah. The in a minute. First. The first contact was actually my squad. As we're pushing, like, not uncommon to come into an area and see like people like leave. Like, okay, I'll be back when this is over. Like, this was a straight flee. Like, they're grabbing everything they can and their kids and like running for their lives because they know something's about to get real bad. I remember I asked one guy where the Taliban was, and he just kind of smiled at me and kept like running away. And then the next one I asked, like, waved his arms at the entire green zone. He's like, Taliban. And then he laughed at me and ran.
They're right here.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
And the entire time I'm following and trace, like walking like damn near knee high mud and boots and corn, and I can't see a damn thing.
Yeah.
Because they flooded the fields the night before. It was ridiculous.
Yep. And we ended up.
They flooded them deliberately to just to impede you.
Slow us down. Yep. About 10 minutes later, started getting lit up by a medium machine gun to the north. They stopped for a little while, but the second they saw anybody with a radio on them move, they'd start again. That was off and on for probably about an hour and a half. Until we ended up getting. We had a Cobra and a Huey on station. We had two helicopters on station. And I remember at one point they come in on a gun run because the Taliban position was only about like 120 meters away. And there was a tree line between us, which I'm not going to go through because I know they're trying to draw us into IEDs because that was a pretty common tactic they would use. But this helo comes in and he lights them up with these helos come in and they light them up with the guns. And the Taliban decided it was a good idea to shoot at the helicopters. So they come back around, and I'll never forget this, hearing them over the radio saying, be advised, they just shot at us. That's a bad fucking idea. Keep your heads down. We're coming in again, but we're going to come in with rockets this time, and it's definitely danger close. So needless to say, when they came in with those 2.75-inch rockets and just demolished that tree line, Mr. Terry Taliban he wasn't able to play anymore.
No. So were they in the tree line?
Mm-hmm. You're in the every tree line has a canal, a canal or ditch, and they were in that.
And they weren't even just in the tree line. Like while you guys were engaged, we had that tree monkey up there shooting at us, and I had my first fire team like unload on his butt, like literally shooting squirrels in a tree. Like, come on, man, what are you doing? Where's your evac route out.
I think the best part of the tree monkey thing was Lieutenant Parks. When he gets in this canal, he's like, all right, they can't shoot at me unless they're in the trees. And just then they start lighting up. And he's like, they're in the fucking tree. Damn
it. You know? Dude, he tells that story like as a major, like 10 years later.
He would bring me up to talk to his student about that story.
Yep.
Well, never say it's quiet, never say it's slow in police work, because the second you say it's slow or quiet, all shit's, going to break loose. Well, they can't get me unless they're in the trees is a perfect invitation to make sure somebody's in the fucking trees.
Yeah.
And they're pushing through trying to get what happens after they blow the tree line out. Is it wide open for you guys at that point?
Yeah, I mean, what? The terrain's the
same. Rob, you guys were engaging them and pushing forward, and our platoons aren't. And his, illustrious years of being around, he's just sitting there not even shooting, just recording the whole thing.
No, he shot. He shot. He did. Yeah. He also killed the goats. One of the goats. So after that, we kept pushing, and we ended up taking over a compound to spend a couple days in. The owner of the compound was still there, and he was probably, I'm pretty sure he graduated the same high school the same year as Jesus did.
He's that old. Rob, before the compound, before we made entry into the compound.
You make me bring this up. The grenade?
Yep, the grenade.
I didn't want to. Yeah, we were.
Well, we were like in an L shape on this like tree line and like canal, right, bud?
Mm-hmm.
and we had that wall, and we had security set, and then all of a sudden we hear clunk, boom, they threw the grenade into the canal, so the canal took the explosion up, and this Rob grabs one, it's like, here, have some America, motherfucker, and throws another one back over the wall at him.
Well, you know.
Oh, the details on it.
For trading grenades.
Yeah. So they threw an old Russian style grenade, which really they're not that strong. Like they're not that big compared to ours. It landed in a canal right next to one of the machine gunners who's trying to figure out which it dropped in the water, and then it like blew up and like sprayed him with water, and he's just like in shock. So I got up and I ran over to the building and I pulled a grenade and no helmet on. I think my flak was like half undone. And I throw a grenade over the wall, and when it goes off, I do like a muscle up onto the wall. I'm like, fuck you, mine's bigger, bitch. But then I realized the rifle are still in the ditch in the canal. Like I just got up without them. But I hopped, and I'm exposed now to God and everybody. I hopped down, went over, and Lance Corporal's hands me my rifle. He's like, here you go, Sergeant. I was like, yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, but you looked cool.
And then
oh yeah, I look. It was straight up.
Rule
yeah.
number two, bro. Look cool. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's cool. Don't get lost. Yeah. And if you get lost, look cool.
Yeah. And that's when we took over that old guy's compound right after that. We called him Blue. He was our boy.
Oh, Blue.
Tom, not to move forward too soon, but to just give you an idea of like the amount of resistance and the day-to-day ops that these guys were facing. By the time I rejoined the company 2 weeks in, the patrol base that my guys were at a pretty key intersection, T-shaped intersection in the Northern Green Zone, we referred to as Route Red. That was about what, Rob, like 800 meters from Falad?
Yeah.
Yeah. So less than a click. And that's just due to the terrain, the amount of enemy fighters, and just the kind of their defense and depth laydown that they had for having that safe haven for years. I mean, this was
right
fall, almost fall of 2010. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you guys are scrapping and scraping and inching your way forward.
Oh, these dudes were every day, man. These guys would LD. And they can tell it better than I can, obviously, but they were there. But they would LD from one compound, get on a patrol route, some kind of firefight, some kind of IED, complex ambush stuff, call it 50, 100 meters, harbor up, go at it the next day. Like, it was just, yeah.
Getting grenade fights where you're literally just chucking hand grenades back and forth over walls at each other and stuff, yeah.
Well, that first day, man, when we pushed out at, what was that, 06? August 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was a gunfight all day long until evening. And I mean, guys were getting hit. Like even third platoon was on the more northern flank from us, I believe, on the other side of Triumph. And it's just all sorts of craziness going on.
Yeah, that's that first day is when Harvey and Caleb got hit, both of them.
Yeah,
that first day with Herbal Town. Yeah,
and both are doing good.
I think people maybe forget that when you talk about, you know, we're looking in hindsight, and you're saying, "Oh, it was a firefight, and rounds are going off, and this and that other thing." Like you said, this is not ineffective fighting. This is effective fighting. You know, this is full contact. Like every 50 meters is a first down for you guys, but at the same time, that's a hard fought, you know, players getting injured every 10 yards.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was in like having a lot of the, like he said, having the, like, honestly, that entire deployment battalion wide, we had some of the best NCOs that were available in the Marine Corps. Hands down. Like, we had guys that were Ramadi, Fallujah, whole mixture of guys that did, like, anywhere from the initial push that were all battle-hardened individuals that have been through fights and everything, that have earned their stripes and even the blood stripe type deal. And you had those guys telling us, like, especially as a boot, this is my first deployment, and as a boot, you're having these guys look at us and they're like, yeah, no, even through all that, we never experienced this much contact. Like, this is insane. And you're like sitting there as a boot and you're like, okay. Gotcha. So is there advice on how to proceed from here? So we live, anything. I mean, right. Because we had anywhere from Gunny Hussey to, McGregor to all the rest of those guys. That are like these guys that, I mean, even McGregor is out there like trying to draw contact. If we actually went on a patrol once where we didn't get shot at for like 45 minutes. And it was just like, oh, this is new. So naturally, my acting platoon sergeant at that time after Fernandez got hit, exposes himself out of a tree line in an open field with his cigarette in his mouth, you know, just smoking like he always is. Cause you never see this guy without a cigarette. He, sleeps. Well, nowadays he's done, but yeah, back in the day, it was like he slept with a cigarette in his mouth, and he would walk out there and opened his map completely, undid the tape from our section and everything, put his antenna all the way up in the air, and just stood out there in the open field like, no, we're going to pick a fight. Yeah, no, these guys are going to shoot at us. Yeah, he got like three holes through his map that like 5 seconds later. So then, yeah, we got a good fight.
So now, isn't that true that if you've taking that much contact, 45 minutes of quiet is going to be it's going to be a little bit discomforting.
Oh, bro.
Because you're wondering when the other shoe is going to drop. I mean, hear the gunfire and know where it's coming from, because it's going to come. It's just a question of when and where. The fact that it's not coming is like, oh, shit.
I honestly believed our paranoid guy that thought they were tunneling underneath us at that point when we didn't get shot at for 45 minutes. I'm like, oh, yep, no, they're definitely tunneling. Yep, tunneling.
Yeah, I think
that was even from our Marja experience, man, when we were down with 3-6, because you would hear it. You know, Marja was about 8 to 10 clicks to the east of us, and every day, like clockwork, it was like, hey, like 10, 10:30, and then, you know, so like essentially late morning and then early evening, it was like, yep, all hell's about to break loose, yeah.
And then I think even worse than like being out for like 45 minutes and not getting shot at is the getting shot at and it stops and then starts again on and off for a while. As you know, they're maneuvering, you know, they're trying to do something, or this could be, they actually broke contact and they got out of there. But most of the time, like they're pulling up like a Dishka 12.7, a heavy machine gun, and
you're
trying to get on your flanks and stuff. And like, and now it's going to get real fun.
So. Yeah. They didn't go quiet for nothing.
No, yeah, they just
well, they were smart, man. Like you said, everything was calculated, like Rob alluded to. Like, they pick and chose where, you know, it wasn't meet me at the flagpole at 3 o'clock, right? Like, it was like, we're gonna pick and choose where the flagpole is today. And they were just really good at they were never gonna engage you without a terrain feature between you and them, right? They had known egress routes. And so by the time, because they knew, they used our own aggression against us. So like by the time we could maneuver onto their like their position, even if they were trying to lure us in or not, which we kind of learned some pretty valuable lessons later in that deployment about that. But their TTPs were spot on, man. And I mean, we didn't see, you know how Iraq, you get a lot of the videos and the photos of the deceased or like just wounded dudes jacked up, you know, like that wasn't Afghan at all. Because they weren't going to allow you to get that kind of propaganda. You know what I mean? So they were right. Battle-hardened dudes from, I mean, I think they were true, like Mujahideen that fought the Russians in the 70s.
I was going to say that this is a large component of people that have fought the Soviet army to a standstill. You know, they weren't going to be cowed by just, oh, the American Marines are here, let's give up. Oh shit. No, they were like, well, fuck it. We fought the Soviets. We'll fight the Americans too.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, absolutely, bro.
Then you have the added bonus of children who didn't get to prove themselves fighting the Soviets, but whose parents did, are saying, yes. Oh no, I have to prove myself to the previous generation. And I have to be just as hard and just as tough as they were. So it's a generational thing that the kids are got to live up to.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And the heck of it is like, Rob and Mike, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. Like, we were getting that radio chatter from the Taliban that these guys, when we shoot at them, they don't go anywhere. They stay. and they keep pushing forward towards us.
Yeah, I remember that chatter. It was the Taliban commit leaders were telling their guys to not attack the American Marines, to get behind us, attack the Brits again, because we're not human. We don't run from their fire. We run at it, and we will kill them. Yeah.
Hell
yeah.
They knew, man. They knew, like, once they picked where the flagpole was, like, you start the clock, you start the game clock, right? And they knew, like, 10 to 15 minutes, we're going to bring in air, right? And so a lot of it even got to where, not that they were defeated by any means, because obviously 3-5 came in after us, and they had a hell of a deployment as well, but with resistance. But they definitely, towards the end, like, it became more harassing style, right? TTPs and firefights, and because they knew, man, they knew for 10 to 15 minutes they're going to be able to screw around with us, and then they're just going to be feet.
I think
it turned more into the lure us into an ambush type deal, like where they knew they could draw us into contact, set IEDs, set multiple ones, so that way we have multiple casualties, draw us into those kill zones, and then break contact before air shows up. And they kind of, they figured out how to do that really efficiently. And at the same time, is it's like we were talking about with the Mujahideen guys, though, where we were at, we had like a bunch of A&A with us, and all of them were absolute shit, except for like two or three of them that were the old crusty dudes that were all former Mujahideen. Like, they all had the crescent moon tattoos everywhere all over them. And they were all former Mujahideen that fought against the Russians and now are fighting against the Taliban, because they're essentially in that split where, like, no, we fought against the Russians. We didn't like what they were doing. And now the Taliban are doing the exact things the Russians were doing. We want to fight. And those guys had no fear. Like, they would stand right out there. Like, we called him Sully, and because none of us could pronounce his actual name, but he was like easily 65, 70 years old out there, A&A soldier, fucking, like, I'm like, oh yeah, do you know? Oh, go right ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Mujahideen would actually be on your side.
Yeah.
Some of them, yeah.
As they believed it, as they were explaining it through the interpreter that one time, was the true Mujahideen are fighting against the Taliban. The other extremists are the same thing as the Russians. They're just as evil. They're just as bad. They're all worried about the drug money and what they can get for power. And that was it.
Right. That's the
Tom talking about. Yeah, exactly. Yep. It was all, dude, everything. You follow the drugs, you follow the money. And we had what we really started to learn on that deployment was that, yes, you're a Marine. Yes, you're here in that capacity. But until, like, not to go completely coin, obviously, but like you're in conventional fighting every day via unconventional means, for sure. But if you take 5 minutes of every day and kind of put your cop hat on, and you got with our LEP that was on that deployment, Ronnie Alexander, who phenomenal American, man. Like, I'm sure you've had him on here, actually. Yeah. Dude, he would tell you, he'd be like, yeah, man, let's go find some opium today so we can arrest some bad guys. He goes, yeah, it's fun to shoot guns and do our job, but, like, at the end of the day, if you really want to have the strategic impact you're trying to have instead of just the tactical impact, right? Dude, yeah, that was definitely the telltale of that AO towards the end, for sure. So, and then, Jake, you're...
Earlier in the... Go ahead. Our platoon coming back from an operation out by, like, Nowzad and Musicala area. We stopped some dirty A&A or A&P, some comps, and seized, I think it was like $10 million worth of black tar heroin. Like, that's $10 million that we took away from the Taliban.
Yeah, exactly. How many guns? So very, is that? How many bullets similar. Is that? How many RPGs is that?
Yep. We did a snap BCP. What was the name of that place, Rob, that right before, dude, it was the last village we went to before Sangin, where the tunnel systems were.
Oh,
Hormuz? That sounds right. That's wrong, man.
No, you're talking about the mountain range on the north side of the river, right?
It was near the foot.
Yes. There you go, Bert. Washir. Nonetheless, wherever it was. Bashir. Say that again? Bashir.
Washir.
There we go. All right. Now that we got that cleared up, right? So, Mikey here.
It's always important to get that.
You know, from now. Right. I'm from South Alabama, so I'm in my true world here when I'm doing about 59, 60 miles an hour in a Mat V, which Mat V's don't go 60 miles an hour. I'm yeeing through the desert, right, after this shithead in a white car. And
Waffle Fields, mind you.
Yeah, exactly. We'd already, like, used our EOF, our escalation of force procedures on this guy to get him to stop. Like, we've shot pirate at him. My buddy, my gunner, Patrick Rowe, who, you know, rest his soul, man, he's no longer here with us. But he's shooting 50 cal bursts at this guy, and he's still just not stopping. So we, like, essentially almost wrecked this fool to get him to stop. And sure enough, man, we roll him up, and we start. I even made a video because back then I was young and stupid. We made a video called Pimp His Ride, and that was when that show was famous on MTV with Exhibit. So we pimped his ride, man. We start cutting up dashes, cutting up seats, and we find a little over 10 mil in Pakistani currency with, like, ledgers. So it was like Taliban drug money that they were essentially the courier for going to pay the guys in that area, you know. So
could you make it a traffic stop and getting a doper off the street?
Dude, yeah. Right? I felt like a cop on the beat, man.
Yeah, obviously, a 50 cal does help.
Back. Yeah, I wish I had those.
Hey, Mike, wasn't there some incendiary type items involved?
I can't confirm. Me and Jesse Gant are still active duty, so we can't talk about incendiary grenades on here or denying the enemy freedom of movement with melting engine blocks. So, but yes, there was
anything that happened was purely accidental.
Right.
Right. Hey, I was just tired of carrying the damn thing, bro.
Yes. You bring up a good point. One of the things that we because people would talk about how drug use is a victimless crime or drug possession, things like that, and we used to always say, no, when I go out and I bust dopers, you'll watch your burglaries go down, you'll watch your assaults go down, you'll watch a lot of that stuff go down. And it's the same thing, you know, it just carries over because shitheads are shitheads. We talk about this on the show all the time. Shitheads are fucking shitheads. Our assholes are going to asshole no matter what country or where they're at. So by you taking down this dude, you know, you're cutting off a key logistical support element, really, because that's all it is. That's how they're funding their shit.
And their big deal is, like, the same thing is it's the hardcore stuff. Like, so black tar heroin made out of the poppy, which poppy obviously is used for tons of medical uses, like such as morphine and everything else. It's just they're making the straight up black tar heroin that's going into China that they're giving little kids for their sweatshops to make your Apple phone.
But
I know.
Let's not talk about that.
We're having this conversation.
No. But the big thing is, but then the funny part is then you'd run into the guys just smoking the Afghan Kush that would give us all the intel we'd ever want because they'd make like bongs out of their drugs and just sit there. And you're like, okay, where are they at? If you go down this way, then watch out for the IED. Then you take a left and you come up on this compound and you're like, that was the easiest interrogation I've ever done in my life. Okay. You want an MRE? I'm sure you're getting the munchies. Yeah. Okay. I'll take that. Yeah. All
Stoner's
right,
going to snitch, man.
Well, and Tom, it was just, dude, as a young sergeant on that deployment, man, like the bigger theme of this conversation was that you learned that, like, you truly learned tactical patience, right? You weren't going to rush to your death. You weren't going to rush to failure. Which we did early in that deployment. We rushed into some hard lessons learned. And then you learn, man, that, like, that little pea shooter, your little primary weapon, your M4 that you're carrying, like, in the grand scheme of things, you can do so much more damage if you just think outside the box and kind of become that tactician. And what we talk about today, like, that maneuverist, right, that maneuver warfare approach. So, like, I really learned that on that deployment. You really learn, like, hey, man, if you really want to have an impact, my M4 and my squad's ability to, like, find, fix, and flank is important, but it's definitely not the answer. It's not to say all be all.
Yeah. I always, people always ask what the most realistic cop movie is. And I say, well, if you combine the movie Colors with the movie Super Troopers, you'll get close, you know, but, one of the things.
Damn, I was going to go end of watch, man.
Yeah, no, right. One of the things that I always point to in the movie Colors was when Robert Duvall tells Sean Penn the story about the two bulls, you know, the dad bull and the son bull. And I don't know if you guys know this. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but basically the gist of it is his father bull and a son bull are standing on top of a hill and they look down at a field of cows. And the young bull says, let's run down and fuck one of those cows. And the older bull says, no, we're going to walk down and fuck them all.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, patience, the tactics, the patience, the slow play is going to get you a better result every time.
Whenever I do the slow play quote, I always like to go secondhand Lions on that just because Robert Duvall definitely played the slow play on that movie where, oh yeah, by the way, we're millionaires. But yeah, we're going to beat up everybody in the process.
We'll see what he's selling first, and then we'll shoot him later.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Exactly. So through that deployment and through that time, how big, I mean, I guess you said you pushed 800 meters, right? Total? Just in that initial?
No, just that weeks? Initial like 2 weeks.
2 weeks? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So how far did you end up pushing overall, and how long did it take?
32 days, and we pushed about 1,500 meters total, give or take.
Wow.
So, and then we ended up coming back and launching on another operation into the Southern Green Zone. Like, we came back for a day and went back out that the next day, which that's another one for the books.
Yeah. You did 32 days straight, then you went back, had 24 hours rest, and then back out at it again for how long?
That one was short.
Same, yeah.
Only 3 or 4 days, but we pushed back out because September 18th were going to be the elections. So on the 16th, mm-hmm. we pushed out to create a buffer, a security like buffer, so that the Afghans could go vote. And the Taliban did not like that. So
I got put on pogue duty, taking care of post while y'all were out there.
Thank God. It wound up mattering, bro.
It did. I'm not you. Especially on the 18th, I've already
told you. It wound up making a huge difference.
How so? We had some fun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Eagle's Nest, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that make such a difference?
Oh, yeah. Rob, you shot the Micklick. You want to start this thing off?
Let's start with the Micklick, and I'll bring up the me having to tell the Brits because I'm playing liaison with the company COC and the British COC.
So the Southern Green Zone operation, it was of that whole time. There was actually 2 days where we actually had stuff happen. It was the first day on the 16th, pushed out about 05 in the morning. I was the only squad from my platoon that pushed out. It was Mike's platoon and then my squad. We had got our vehicles back and we were going to be their support. And the first thing that we were doing was going to launch a Micklick, a mine clearing line charge. So 1,750 pounds of C4.
Hang on. Real quick. Inject. We haven't even LD'd yet, bro. And what's going on? Sitting in the freaking AA. In the FOB.
Yeah, they're taking rounds inside the battalion FOB.
Oh, we're taking sniper fire, Tom, like before we even LD.
Yeah.
Of course.
They tie me out.
And that matters. That matters in a minute. It plays into my decision making in a minute.
And Mike, on that, we'd already taken a couple RPGs to the dang HESCO barriers of FOB Jackson.
Yep. So we push out the engineers that are with me, shoot the Micklick. Best part of that whole part, the Micklick, was hear them do the countdown, and it didn't go off, which means someone's going to have to run out there and like prime into it manually. But like the countdown, 3, 2, 1, mark, 1, 2, 3, and he didn't come off the mic fast enough and goes, fuck. So engineer has to get out of his vehicle, and we're definitely too close as it is, runs over to it, primes
in,
and is hauling ass trying to get there before this thing goes off. Eats shit running through this field, does a perfect like combat roll from the movies back on without missing a beat, gets in his vehicle, right? Then this thing goes off. Oh, and it was so bad, I was choking on the dust in my vehicle. But we got the lane.
On that Micklick, so when you guys blew that, I was down in the... You remember where the British Chow Hall was on Fob Jackson? That big three-story building? I was down there with the British COC watching all that on their screens, like keeping them updated about what we're doing. And I'm like, all right, gents, it's about to go. It didn't go.
Yeah. Like,
and then we see him running, and then when it finally went, they're like, what's going on? And then everything just started falling off the walls down in that little cellar.
Yeah. Then a couple minutes later, after that goes off, Mike's platoon comes out, and I'm standing outside my vehicle, and I remember Mike and I were talking about, like, how big that was. He was like, my ears were still ringing. Yeah, I'd just given up another lot of my nine lives. And I remember... remember distinctly, and I'll pass this off to you after this, Mike, was Mike and I are talking, and a round went right between us, and we just kind of, like, looked at each other, got on a knee, shook his hand. I was like, time to do some work, dude. I'll talk to you later.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Time to go pay the bills, man.
I'll let you...
Yeah, I think... No, that's a great segue, bro, because, like, I think at that point in the deployment, like I said, we were taking sniper fire before we even LD'd. From across the river. I think at that point in the deployment, we were just so not comfortable by any means, but we were just so accustomed to, like, the difference in getting shot at, right? And it's real, and then, like, right, getting screwed around with, you know. And so when you hear that whiz, that crack, or just the ballistics of the round, right, you're like, okay, you know, that tickled, right? But, like, the difference of, like, the sniper that's shooting 12 feet over your head, you're like, okay, asshole, like, keep firing, because I'm gonna pinpoint you and I'm gonna kill you, right? So, yeah, man, we first platoon proofed the lane for us, and dude, obviously, to say they knew we were coming is an understatement, right? Like, looking back on it, if I'm Monday morning quarterback everything, like, it's super irritating, but, like, it kind of led to some pretty courageous events, but all right, so I guess the way the terrain and the layout was south of Fob Jackson, you had about 200 meters of open field of standoff. You had the Hellman River to the eastern flank of the Fob there, running north-south, paralleling the 611. And then just like in the Hellman River Valley there, you had all those tree lines and everything essentially, like, you had compounds that would connect to compounds and then canals, and everything was kind of just like elaborate canal or irrigation system, you know, and they knew, man, again, we're fighting some guys that knew what the hell they were doing, and they knew, okay, there's a 50 cal and a Mark 19 Eagle's Nest post on top of that fob where the Americans are. I know the effective capabilities of that weapon, those weapon systems. I know that they can see me if I go here. They can't see me if I go here. And sure enough, bro, like, as soon as we get through, kind of do a forward passage of lines through first platoon and start that clear south, literally the first compound you come to, once we get on the southern edge of that, you can't see friendlies, right?
Okay.
And it's 77 meters. And this is going to matter in a minute. So it's 77 meters across the river. I know that for a fact. across the river is JDAM City. It's just blown out buildings, bro. Like, just stuff that you're like, looks like ancient Roman or Greek, like, ruins, you know? And you're like, all right, cool. I guess we've been doing some fighting.
Something out of a Mad Max movie.
Yeah, bro, for sure. And so to paint a better picture for you, our second squad, Train, Sergeant Trantham, we called him Train. He's like 6'5", old, grumpy, great dude, man, solid American. He actually just picked up first sergeant, so congrats, Train, if you ever listen to this. His guys had broken off to the northeast, and we're going to establish our security element, the northern end of our security element, in an adjacent position. But like Birch has already alluded to, man, like, the terrain. Like once you go into those cornfields, think of like Field of Dreams and like, and then getting shot at, like you have no situational awareness, like whatsoever.
Right.
And it's just tough, man. It's just really tough to pinpoint stuff and get your whereabouts and kind of collect your bearings. So they break off. We push south. We being me and third squad, which is Matt Hood. He also just got promoted to first sergeant. They both abandoned the infantry, but that's all right. Well, that's another conversation for another day. his squad. He was actually the main effort for this clear. My lieutenant. We like to rotate kind of who's who in the zoo, and it was Matt's turn up to go to bat, and he did a great job, man. So I set in the southern portion of the L shape, if you will, along the Helmand River and on a tree line in the canal. Train is to the north, and there's this compound in between. Again, the first compound we come to paint a better picture for you, about 75 meters further south is another compound. So it's literally compound, open field, Helmand River, another compound. So we're literally in a kill box. The why did Mike decide, hey, I'm going to set up right here? I got proud, man. I got really proud, and I was really arrogant, to be honest. And I think I was kind of toeing that line of like, you know, between arrogant and confident. And that dude had been screwing around with us for about 30 minutes now. And I'm like, dude, I'm going to find this bastard and I'm going to blow him away. I mean, I had stacked air for days. I'm like, we got plenty of air assets. He's shooting at us. He's toying with us. He's not affecting us at all, but he's just bothering me. Right.
So right, this is pissing me off.
Right. Like, you're not going to do that. Well, you know, like, I'm better than you, bitch, you know? So, and he did, man. He drew us in knowing what I knew now. He definitely, hey, baby girl, you want to go brush your teeth? Okay. Go talk to Grandma. Grandma will let you brush your teeth. That's my little 3-year-old daughter, by the way.
That's awesome.
Sorry. So,
you got her taught, right. Yeah, she's like, I want to brush my teeth.
Oh, bro. She's brushed her teeth like 4 times today.
That's awesome.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. So, right. Me too, bro. I'm only at 2 today. So we set in, man. And sure enough, bro, like you couldn't have painted it. Like it's so obvious now, right, that you look back and talk on it. Matt's squad, probably 12 dudes plus, you know, engineers, some A&A. And mind you, we're at the point in the deployment where like, hey, we're not smelling the barn, but like, we got a job to do. But at the same time, like, we'll let the A&A go first. Yeah, like we got to transition power, right? Like, we'll let those dudes go first. And so
you've got just enough confidence to be dangerous.
Correct. Exactly. So we're set in, man. Security set. It's kind of the calm before the storm. They make entry. About 30 to 45 seconds goes by, and you just hear that worst sound in the world, right? Like you just hear a boom, and you know, like, okay, this is not going to be good, right? Like it's a lot of dudes in a small space. And sure enough, man, like all hell breaks loose at that point. Second squad to the north, about 100 meters, it turns out, starts taking pretty heavy fire on their position. They have a casualty, gunshot wound to the neck. Nick Wurst missed his carotid artery by like millimeters. He's actually a cop in Amarillo, is it, Rob?
Yeah. Amarillo or like Laredo, somewhere in Texas, yeah.
Texas, and he still has that scar down the left side of his throat, all the way down to his chest.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he does look prettier with that scar now, at least. Yeah. I just want to throw that out there.
I mean, he got married.
I know.
Like, who married that guy?
Pain is temporary, glory is forever, and chicks dig scars.
There it is, man. Absolutely. Amen. So now we're kind of knee deep in the fun stuff, right? So, and I'll be honest, man, you don't have favorites. You love your brothers equally, but aside from the dude on this podcast with me, Matt Hood was my best friend, man. And when that dude comes running out and he's just bloody, you know, like I quickly was no longer arrogant. I'm like, oh shit. Like, holy crap, man. What did we just walk into? I mean, my boys are rocking and rolling. I hear fire to the north, and all Matt can tell me, man, he's pale. He essentially caught a rock through his lip. And so he has a hole in his jaw. and he's bleeding, but it looks a lot worse, right? It just looks worse.
Yeah.
It's in the pantry, baby girl. Go ask Grandma. Daddy's talking on the phone. Can you go ask Grandma for it? Go ask Grandma. So he comes out, he takes a knee next to me. I'm already on the hook, like letting everybody know what's going on, trying to get air dialed in. And he looks at me, man, and he goes, Mike, it's bad, bro. Mike, it's bad, man. Like, that's all he could tell me. And I'm like, dude, you're not helping the situation right now. Right. Like, you're making it worse. And so I'm finally just like, Matt, stop, like, talk to me, man. He's like, both engineers are down, 2A and A are down. I'm like, okay, cool. I got a number. I send the corpsman in. We get them out. And again, we're trapped in this little box, right? So like, we're in a good position, but at the same time, like we're in their kill zone for sure.
You're making the best of a bad situation.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the end of the day, we're going to have to fight our way out of this, right? I can't maneuver to the east. I'm not going to cross the river and get tied off. So essentially I got Cobras and Hueys in one ear and I got Kazovac in the other, talking to obviously my platoon commander. We got battalion leadership, so terrain feature back with first platoon. And I know if I'm like nervously and anxiously waiting in this essentially mini courtyard, I can't imagine what they were thinking at this point or feeling. But, bro, I had probably the most gangster, like war-fighting Marine of all time in Drew Crossland, second award private. Okay. He's not the kid you take on Libo.
He's doing good, by the way. Lives about 20 minutes away from me.
He's always good on Libo. I mean, just don't put him in the elevator with the battalion commander. You'll be good.
That's it. He's the guy you have to apologize for before you introduce him to your friends.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly, Tom. Exactly.
He might go Muhammad Ali on the colonel.
But, bro, I mean, I've never met a machine gunner, so like an accuracy by volume of fire guy, right? I've never met a machine gunner who is a DM, who has one of the highest pistol scores in the company. Like, this kid's just, he's just a jack of all trades, man. He's just a great, great infantryman. Bro, when he turned around at me in what felt like 10 minutes, I was told it was like a couple of like hour and a half at this point. So I got the fog of war going on for sure. Like some time warp stuff. You know, we're still hooking and jabbing, doing our thing. Everything's cool. But I thought it was like 10 minutes. And they're like, no, bro, you've been here for like an hour and a half. He turns around and looks at me and goes, hey, we're red on 7-6-2. And I'm like, wow. All right. That's not good. You know? So, at that point, I mean, we start calling, obviously shuffling, moving some pieces around, shuffling some resupply stuff at the company level. Obviously casualties are taking precedence as well. So both A and A are dead. We found that out pretty quick. So we get them out, just kind of get them off to the side. Both of our engineers are urgent surgical at that time. That was a real thing. So we got corpsmen working on them. We got gun runs happening. They volleyed RPGs at us at this point. So a lot of effective things are happening, but nothing's happening, if that makes sense. Right.
It's like kind of we're treading water.
Yeah. Like it's a lot of like, it's like a heavyweight fight. Like they're throwing some punches and we're throwing some punches, but I even went up to Crossland at one point and my APL man was TC Holbert. you want to talk about a leadership challenge, and here's why. Because that guy, let's see, he was an HM1 in the Navy. Ooh, picks up E6 in the Navy. He's a corpsman, bro. He did 4 pumps to Iraq. Like, I've seen some stuff, right?
No shit, yeah.
Leaves Beast. The Navy, joins the Marine Corps, and he's now young Sergeant Monday's APL when this dude's got more experience in his pinky than I do in my entire body. Right. Like, so to say, I leveraged that guy, man. Like we satellite patrolled everywhere. I would take my squad, split them 6 and 6, tell TC to go over here and play and have no reservation, like at all. And so when he looked at me, man, at that point in this thing. And he's like, Mike, it's like shooting ghosts, man. He goes, I can't shoot what I can't see. And I'm like, holy shit. Okay. This is real. Right. So not that it wasn't real up to that point, but I'm like, okay, we're expending a lot of, we're expending a lot of energy and not accomplishing anything. Right. So it's at that point where I look at my platoon commander, Lieutenant Brian Coughlin, the Irish dude from Brooklyn, who may as well have had a set of corporal chevrons instead of lieutenant bars. That guy was a savage, man. And he let us sergeants be sergeants, and he's a solid dude, but, and still is, you know, I don't even know. I think he's back in New York doing his own thing now with, life insurance. I think is what he sells. But, anyway, he's doing well for himself and extremely happy. But, bro, he looks at me and he's like, yeah, we got to call it in, Mike. We don't have a choice. And so back to the 77 meters away, right? So on August 9th, I had been medevaced the first time coming into Sangin. Here we are, September 16th, less than 30 days later. I lied my ass off at Leatherneck at my concussion evaluation to get back out to the boys.
right.
I had to do this physical assessment. And of course the doc's like, it was like run around in your gear, jumping jet, like calisthenics, right? Get your heart rate up. He's like, are you dizzy? Nope. Take your sunglasses off. And I'm like squinting. And he's like, are you sensitive to light? I'm like, nope. He's like, you got a headache? I'm like, nope. And he's like, all right, cool.
Not as far as you know.
Sweet. Right. Not as far as I know. I'm not a doctor. Right. So to say my head had not healed the first time is probably an understatement. Right. So that matters because we take, we get fixed wing, Stoic 7-6 and Stoic 77-1-2 check in from Kandahar, and they drop a GBU 12, man, 500 pounder, 77 meters away. And I think like just looking back on it, like it was totally necessary. Not fun. I woke up with Cogs doing blood sweeps in my face. He's like, dude, I thought you were dead.
So did I.
I will say at that point in time, I do remember hearing the most beautiful sound on the battlefield at that point in time, and that was silence. What the gun runs had confirmed was about 39 to 45 fighters. So like a platoon reinforced fighters on our position. So they actually had the 3-1 advantage against us. So that made me feel a little better, but I was still just kind of taken back that we're 2 hours into this thing and not a lot has happened. So right. GBU 12 goes off. We actually got a moto video that we showed at the ball that year, and Birch can probably speak to this from his viewpoint. That boom goes off right by the river, and you see this leg and this body go flying, bro, and it's pretty sweet.
So I was in a very good position on that when I saw that, and the Brits didn't like that we were blowing stuff up. I told them. I was like, "Well, you can take it up. You can take it up with Colonel Tipton. I'm just passing word."
If you can't tell, we have a running tradition of 3-7 of getting bombs dropped right on us. It's okay. I still beat you by 20 meters, so it's all right. I got you.
All right, that's cool, man. That's cool. Challenge accepted. No, right. Joking. So I remember
the contest you don't want to win.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I don't want that trophy. So I remember, man, remember I talked about Birch being thrown on SOG, like it actually wound up mattering because he's up there as a savvy squad leader, like directing machine gun, like heavy machine gun fire. And we actually had these guys in a true L shape, right? Like they're able to impact across the river in the depth of this position that I'm not able to affect. So we had them fixed. We just couldn't, we really just weren't really affecting them with our engagements. So so nonetheless, man, I wake up and I was told I was out for probably 5 to 7 seconds, somewhere in there, 10 seconds. I wake up and he's in my face. It freaks me out to like push him off me. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, bro, I thought you were dead, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, I'm fine. And bro, I go to stand up and I like just fall back down. I'm all jacked up and I don't even know like what's going on at this point. They're like, oh shit, his head, you know? And so this is why, you know, I'm 35 years old. I hope to at least double that and live till I'm 70, but we'll see. the every day that I live and breathe, man, I'll always owe a beer to Rob Moser. So him and Randy Kreitz show up. At this point, we basically call in first platoon. We're like, all right, Mike's dealing with casualties. Mike's dealing with air. Mike's doing all this with his lieutenant. And, like, Mike just got jacked up. So now it's like, hey, like, we got to figure this shit out. So here comes first. And I saw and heard a very friendly face, albeit an LSU fan. But so Rob is carrying me out of the flight at this point at about 200 meters, some shitty terrain.
Yeah.
And me and my awesomeness, right. I have a 1-point swing, and my M4 is just racking his knee, bro, like every left step, right? Like just bam. Man, I hear it, right? But I can't. I'm like, dude, I'm just like being carried. I'm out of it, man. I can't do anything about it. And all I hear is Rob go, bro, when I see you again, I'm going to fucking kill you.
He's still here.
Using
that fucking rifle.
Yeah. So for me, man, that was the 16th. It went on into the night. And there's the 17th and 18th were just as eventful, for sure, from what I've heard and been told. But yeah, so I got Purple Heart number 2 on that day. So I can't really speak to so Sergeant Major Barrett, who wound up being Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, he was the one Mep Sergeant Major at the time. When I went back to Bastion, they like swabbed my nasal cavity, and this really attractive lieutenant commander. I remember that because I haven't seen an attractive woman in a long time. It's like month 7, you know? And, so I get to, I get to Bastion and, she swabs my nasal cavity. And, like, they found cerebral fluid, right, in my nasal cavity. And
yeah, that's not
my,
good.
My dumb ass.
Just for the record, yeah, I'm not a corpsman, but I know that's not good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm no doctor, but I was like, of course, my ass from Alabama. I'm like, what does that mean? She's like, your brain is leaking, Marine. Like, and so when Sergeant Major Barrett saw me, he was like, Monday, what are you doing back here? I'm like, oh, God. You know, like the one Mess Sergeant Major knows my name, and it's not for a good thing. It's in the pantry, baby girl. Go tell Granny you want one. Mom, will you get her a roll up, please? Yeah, so basically I was shut down at that point. He's like, I'm calling black and telling him you're done. Like, and there was like a couple of weeks left in the deployment, you know, and I'm like, bullshit, dude, I'm not staying here if I don't have to. And she's like, do you have kids? And I was like, I do. She's like, do you want to remember their names? I'm like, well, yeah. She goes, then you're not leaving. I'm like, all right, cool. I guess I'm done. Right. So at that point it became obviously bigger than me and that's
yeah, when you need an oil pan in your driveway for your brain fluid, it's time to reconsider your life choices and maybe make some adjustments.
Right?
To take over on that, so, I had to use the same thing on Mike. I carried him out. Nick Wurst, when he got hit, our company Gunny Sean comes out on a four-wheeler ATV on a quad with a trailer that he stole from the Brits. Just comes like bogging out on it. He's like, where are the casualties? So I took him to Wurst and we got Wurst out. And then I turn around as Gunny Sean's driving off and here comes third squad from our platoon, the battalion jump, but they're trying to keep up with the battalion commander, the battalion sergeant major, and the battalion gunner. All three of them are like dead sprinting with their personal security attachment and a rifle squad behind them, like trying to catch up. They asked me to take them up to where the company's in the fight. I take them up there, and that's when I saw them. I think it was either Wells or Kiernan, one of the two engineers, getting carried out. And I run up.
Kiernan, yeah.
Yeah, it was Kiernan. I run up. I grabbed one of the ANAs, who ended up dying later as a double amputee. When I get back, the sergeant major now, we had like a casualty collection point set up. Like you'd carry a guy about 200 meters, drop him, and then other guys would get him in a vehicle to where he'd get picked up by a bird. And I get there, Sergeant Major asks me how they're doing on ammo, and I knew they needed linked ammo for the 249s and the 240s. So he tells me to rob his, to steal from his security detachment. So I grab what I can, I'm running it up, I remember I'm standing there at this canal, and this is right after we had dropped that 500 pounder, the GBU. And I'm like tossing ammunition to Kenneth Abollins in this canal. And that's when I heard like what my stomach dropped when I heard it, but I heard Mike say my first name. I heard Rob, and I look over, and he's in a whole nother world. So Randy and I put him on our shoulders, and we're carrying him on. And for the first like 50 meters, Mike is like cursing at me. Like, fuck you, Rob, turn around. Like, I gotta get back. Like, the fight's that way. My boys are that way. And he shut up when I was like, Mike, your boys are good. Like, TC and Crossland have them. You gotta worry about your other boys right now. And he's like, right. Yeah, you're. And then he started hitting me with a rifle when I threatened his life. So, I know it's gonna rain now because I like it. Thanks. But.
Well, I think on that note, we're running out of time, but I wanted to say thank you to you guys for being on the show and sharing what the 13th and the 16th sound like days you guys won't ever forget, for sure. But we do try to dedicate each one of our episodes to a brother or a sister who has fallen in the line of duty. And so I wanted to open it up to you guys if you have somebody you want to dedicate your episode.
Oh, yeah, man. Can we do... Well, I have them on my wrist here, and obviously, guys, add to if you want. But so we got Claudio Patino, right, from Snipers. We got Kevin Cueto, yep, from Jump. We got Michael Bailey, Robert Newton, Michael Allen. All right, those are all the guys from that 2010 deployment that were 3-7 proper. So what I have on mine is KIA, Brothers of the Blade, right? OEF, 10.1, live a life worth their sacrifice. So. That's what I try and do every day, man. And I wear it as a reminder. So, to those five studs, man, just, that's what I would go with. And if there's more that I'm missing, please add to.
I've got two.
Yeah. We did Cueto. We did Bailey and Patino so far.
Go ahead, Rob.
Add in Patrick.
And
then also,
Roe was the big part of the reason that I've continued to do what I've continued to do, along with Hebert and all the rest of those guys that were on there. And yeah, that's the reason we're all continuing to stay together. And then we'll have our next reunion 2022, which, by the way, now that you've done all this for us, you're going to have to come out for it and meet all the rest of us in person and deal with all of us.
You know what, maybe I'll bring out the microphones and we'll do like a live Q&A or something. Maybe. I don't know. We'll be
free. Yeah.
Oh, nice, man. Well, yeah, and real quick, it wasn't from the 10 deployment, but, I'm actually sitting in my hometown, man, in Alabama, in my parents' house. And Jason Barfield from the 11 deployment.
Yep.
And Rob knows him. Birch knows him real well. He grew up like 30 minutes from here, joined out of one of my buddies put him in the Marine Corps. Me and his mom stay in touch as just kind of the local Marine Corps network here. So Jason Barfield, man, would be a good one to chalk
Barfield. Barfield was the second one. And then obviously then we had Newton and then D'Augustine, everybody else we lost when we went back for Sangin 2, because obviously it didn't end after this deployment. We all went, all of us, at least me, Hodge, and all the rest of us, we went back for the second time.
Got some more.
He liked the first movie so much, you had to go back for the sequel, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, yeah. So, but no, it's one of those deals that we all try to keep in touch with each other and help support, especially the Gold Star families. All of them, we can't thank them enough, and that's the reason we all continue to do what we do. That's the big aspect, is that just making sure that like it's the famous deal that the dead are only truly gone when we stop speaking their name.
Right. Well, I'd like to rest easy, brothers. We got it from here. And if anybody wants to make donations, Nux for Life, as Corporal Patino's family started a foundation, they've actually reached out to us. Because they were really, really happy with the episode we did for Corporal Patino. So we've got a link on our War Stories website if you want to find our website and then use that to direct yourself over to Nux for Life to make donations to a charitable organization that's working to help the families of fallen Marines. And I appreciate you guys coming. I appreciate you guys being on here and sharing all that stuff with us. You know, everybody that listens to this show, whether they've been there and done that or whether they are curious about it because they've never done it. You know, we just had a listener email us. He emailed us a couple of months back saying he wants to make a difference with his life. And just so you're aware, he emailed me just this week and told me that today he's leaving for boot camp. So as a result of listening to us share our stories, you know, these young men and young women are joining up and continuing the good fight and realizing that they can make a difference themselves. So, you know, just by being here and sharing your experiences, you're making a difference again, a second time. So those sacrifices are not in vain on any front. And we appreciate you guys being here. And if you guys have anything you want to say or anybody you want to say, obviously, hello, say hello to your little girl from all of us.
The star of the show.
I do have one thing.
The star of the show. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
So yeah, the one thing that Mike, the quote he said when he's reading those names, I've got a pretty similar quote. It was up on a sign when we pulled into Fob Jackson. I've got it tattooed on me, and it's the key to immortality is living a life worth remembering. And I can say honestly, like Jake, Mike, Birch, like in all the dudes in that battalion at deployment, like my life will be one worth remembering because I was around men like that. They're the greatest dudes I've ever met. So,
well, if ever there was a story worthy of a telling like Band of Brothers, I think the 3-7, somebody should call Spielberg because you guys really, really do deserve it. And I appreciate you guys being on the show. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or honor.